So are you going to the gym later on?
Straight after this, head to one location and then drive back later on tonight to the other location. So what I do, I drive between all locations.
To train or to manage or to what?
To do all of it. I feel that as a leader, you can't just talk the talk. You have to walk the walk. And it's done so much for me. So I train every day. Right. And yeah, and then if time permits, I train with the students. I want to be on the mat with them and show them that I'm not asking you to do something I'm not willing to do myself.
Right.
But yeah, so manage and coach a little bit. And then a lot of times at this point, every business goes through different stages. And now I'm at the stage where it's all about transferring my knowledge to the coaches so that they can transfer it onwards. And that's a lot to do with relationships, to be honest.
So what would happen if you didn't train one day?
It happens sometimes. Well, now I have a new challenge for 2020 where I will run every... My goal is to run every single day of the whole year. But I feel it. You know, I feel that I'm not... You asked about anxiety and frustration, anger, stress, all of it. Stress, which is the worst thing that we can have, you know, when we have too much stress. It's good stress and there's bad stress. There's stress that lights fire under your ass, if you're allowed to swear on here, I'm not
sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
And then there's stress, which is healthy to a certain extent, that you got to go, right? You got to do. But when that stress becomes overwhelming to the point where, you know, it's consuming you, then it's not healthy. And it's not just, again, my opinion. It's scientifically proven that physical activity as humans, we're meant to move, and it helps decrease stress. So I get agitated a lot easier, and it's important to me to train. It's part of my life.
And do you meditate as well?
I do meditate. I focus mostly on breathing meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Eisman Hoff is probably the most famous, but I actually did a breathing meditation certification as a coach through Dr. Belisa Rinich. She's amazing. She wrote a book called Breathe that she also dedicated actually to my son. And I always thought it was something that was good, but I never really had time to do it. And not until losing my son did I really start focusing on meditation. And it's something that's really, really helpful. Humans should do it more.
I mean, the breathing part must be huge in consideration to your martial arts training as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, when you breathe and how you breathe.
It is important. That's actually how I got to know Dr. Belisa, was doing breathing meditation for athletes, for martial artists, for fighters.
All right.
But this was before losing Liam. And then, you know, when you deal with grief that is on a level where what's seemed more important than life in itself, don't seem, that is more important than life in itself, is gone. How do you find motivation to continue living? And there's moments where you're so overwhelmed with the pain that you have to find an outlet. There's certain things when it comes to grief that's very subjective, that's very individual, but there's also some universal ways to deal with it. And finding outlets is really, really important. And when it comes to the anxiety and depression and so on, that's part of grief, then breathing meditation is something that helped me a lot.
I know you've told this story several times, but I think it would be valuable for our listeners to know about this horrible story of what happened to your son.
Yeah, he was, my son Liam was 15 months when he was killed by a drunk driver at 3:30 in the afternoon, on a Saturday afternoon, the 3rd of September, 2016. And, you know, you learn a lot when you deal with grief. You learn a lot about yourself. And I learned a lot about topics I had no idea about, and I would be very happy to still blissfully live ignorantly too. But at the same time, once my eyes had been opened to how big of a problem drunk driving is in this country, how something that's so easily changed, because it has been done. It's been done in more than 100 countries already. We've lowered the blood alcohol content level. And we know from statistics that this would make sense. It would save human lives and it would save money. It's very rare that you can find bills, law changes that can do both save lives and save money. Usually if you want to save lives, it's going to cost money.
Right.
So this to me was, I was naive enough to think, well, this would be an easy change. But when you have an opposition that's focusing only on the profits, the bottom line of big corporations, then you have a problem within the society, and that's where America is today, unfortunately. And I was blind to that, or I was ignorant to it. I didn't know how big of a problem it was. You see it when it comes to gun control. And I'm not the type of person to necessarily say we shouldn't have any guns. I was in the military myself. I understand the need for weapons, that some people should have the right to weapons. And if you're a good law-abiding citizen, just like in Sweden, if you're a hunter, you can own a gun. Mm. So I'm not necessarily against owning guns. But when 18-year-olds that still can't drink alcohol in this country can go in certain states and buy an assault rifle, that to me, we have a problem.
So just to be clear, what happened that night? This woman was intoxicated and she was driving where? And you guys were where?
So where one of my gyms is in Hawthorne Systems Training Center. We have an apartment above it that we used to stay in. And that day I was actually going to take Liam with some of the fighters, some of my friends from the gym, and we were going to go to the Hermosa Fair. And have like a boys' day out with my son. And I'd been out the night before, so I hadn't slept enough, and I trained and taught that morning. So I said, let me just take a quick nap for an hour. And my wife was preparing for an exam. She was at university still. So her sister went to get food, and she took Liam for a walk. And when she crossed the pedestrian crossing, so again, this was 3:30 in the afternoon, a woman who was 72 years old drove through. My sister-in-law did everything right. She pressed the button, she waited for the lights to change. There's three lanes, the two first cars had already stopped, and as she walked out in crossing the street, this woman plowed through the crossing and hit both my sister-in-law and my son. My sister-in-law broke both bones in her leg, and she was unconscious for a while, but she survived. She's dealing more with the PTSD and the after effects of survivor's guilt and so on. But I ran out. I woke up from hearing police sirens, and I thought it was the alarm at the gym that was going off. So I said to Michelle, I said, the alarm has gone off. And she said, no, it's police cars. I said, they're probably coming because the alarm has gone off. And she said, no, there's ambulance and fire as well. And I got this eerie feeling, and I said, where's Liam? And she said, my sister took him for a walk to get food. And I could tell she got concerned as well, and she called her sister who didn't pick up her phone. And then she left to go look for them. And 5-10 minutes later, I don't know, the neighbor came into the staircase and shouted. And I came out, opened the door, and she said, your baby. And I ran out, and I saw, you know, 200-300 meters down the street where the crossing is, fire, police, ambulances, and I ran down. And my first feeling was very animalistic, of just hurting someone. And when I got there and I saw my son's stroller in two pieces, and I saw his little green frog that he always had with him lying in the middle of the road, I thought, there's no way he survived this. But a policewoman said, he's in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, and he's breathing on his own, and he's got a pulse. So trying to hurt who had hurt me became less of a topic, less important to me than finding out what was going on with my son. So we jumped into the police car and we drove down to the hospital. And when I said I learned a lot, it started that day. And it started with finding out that you can die not just from your heart stopping, which is normally how humans die, but you can actually be declared dead through your brain as well, be brain dead. And it's not the same thing as being in a coma. And so when they decide, in order to declare someone brain dead, you have to do two tests. The first test is to see if there's any type of response, you know. And they did that test and there was no response. And in order to declare someone dead, you have to have two people present, two doctors present. So we had to wait 12 hours. And I think I knew. I realized. So I was able to start processing the fact that my son was no longer there sooner than my wife. My wife is intelligent. She's a rational human being, but she was so consumed with the grief that she kept holding on to the hope that he was going to make it. Mm. And that was the toughest 24 hours of my life. And it's something I wouldn't wish upon my worst enemy. And the next day when the doctors came and my family came in and friends from Sweden, from England came flying out. And to have to make that phone call to my parents and say, my son has been in a serious accident. I don't think he's going to make it. And then knowing that they stayed awake and then having to call them again and say, he's not going to make it. It's something that no human should have to do. And unfortunately, you know, parents lose children anyways because of accidents and diseases that are not preventable. But drunk driving is something that's so preventable. So very early on, while we were still in the hospital, I said to my wife, we're going to make sure that something good is going to come of this. You know, we're going to make sure that my son doesn't just become a statistic, that because of my son, there's going to be change. And it has been, and it will continue to be changed in Liam's name.
So did that woman drive off, or did she stop?
She drove off. She stopped for 20 seconds, apparently. Enough time to... She must have realized what she had done, yeah, and then decided to take off. And that says a lot about her as a human being. And she drove off, but you hear a lot of times about people standing by and not doing anything, the bystander effect. But three good citizens followed her in three different cars and blocked her in a few streets. She tried to shake them off and get away from them, and they blocked her in, and she was arrested that day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that the year before, ironically to the day, the 4th of September 2015, I remember seeing a picture of Alan, the little Syrian kid, the 3-year-old who had drowned.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that picture and thinking, what is his father experiencing right now? Because I remember there was an interview with his dad.
Yeah.
And I tried to put myself in his shoes, and your brain, almost like a defense mechanism, doesn't allow you to go there. And once it became a reality for me, you know, I'm a happy person. I'm a positive person, and I've never dealt with mood swings, anxiety, depression, never in my life. And I've had a lot of clients and students and so on that have, and I could never relate to. I can sympathize with it, but I couldn't empathize with it because it wasn't something that I had experienced myself. And having to have gone through that and come out on the other side, so to speak, because you can, but it's also very easy to get stuck in it,
yeah,
become very bitter, become very angry. And I met a lot of parents, especially dads, that have experienced what I've gone through. And it doesn't have to be through drunk driving or a violent crime. It can be just losing a child. And years down the line, they're still not happy. And that's the only way you can truly measure if you have been able to come out on the other side. It's happiness. Because in the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much money you have, how successful you are, if you're not happy, right? And you've got rich people that are not happy, and you've got successful people that are not happy. But in order to deal with grief, being happy is what you need to work towards. And that's got to be your number one focus. And I can truly say that I live today, I'm happy again, but I live happily with a scar on my heart that will never go away.
Of course. And you guys got pregnant 2 months after Liam died. Is that right?
Yeah. So we were kind of in the process. We wanted Liam to have a sibling that was close in age. Mm. And I'll be honest, you know, when we were still in the hospital, I didn't think my wife was going to make it. I thought she was going to end up in a mental hospital. Mm. She was so broken. And not to say that I wasn't, but I handled it differently. And we handled it, we dealt with our grief very differently, but we also respected each other's way of grieving. And that's key. And it's very common that parents separate after losing a child.
Yes.
And if you loved each other enough to have a child, to create life, because that life is gone now, instead of just one life being lost, two or potentially three lives are lost. Mm. And I think usually it doesn't come down to people stopping loving each other. I think it comes down to not being able to communicate and understand and respect each other's different ways of grieving. So on top of the fight that we have on fighting drunk driving, for me it's important to help other people see through grief, because unfortunately it's the one thing that we know, that we are all at some point going to die and everyone around us is going to die. That means we will all at some point experience grief, whether it's a loved one, a sibling, a parent, you know, even a pet. It's grief. You can lose your job and experience grief. And to be able to see it through, and especially as a man, you know, there's a lot of movements for women, and rightfully so, there should be, but there's very little for us as men, and especially when it comes to emotions. And I figured if I, and the stigma of being a fighter, if I can talk about emotions and what I went through in an honest and raw way, then hopefully it can help someone else. And it could be a soldier coming back from Afghanistan who's dealing with PTSD. But, you know, there's a lot of things that are worse today, but there's a lot of things that are better. And one of the things is that we are allowed to speak about emotions a lot more than we used to be. I spoke to a friend of mine who lost, he doesn't even remember, his brother was so young at the time, but his father never said his son's name ever again. And that was it, from, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you know, be a man, you bottle it up and you move on. Right. The thing is, when you experience grief, you don't move on. It's not going to be a day that I don't think about my son.
Of course.
But you learn to live with it. And in order to do so, you need you be able to speak about your emotions and tell people how you truly feel. Not just other people. You need to be able to tell yourself how you feel. And that's important.
So did anything prepare you to do that? Were those abilities you felt safe and secure in? I mean, it's not, as you say, as a man, it's not automatically... It's not per default that you're able to cry, or that you've been encouraged to cry as a boy or a man.
No.
I mean, when I was growing up, every time you cried, not only from your parents, but from other adults, people told you, like, that's nothing to cry about. You shouldn't cry, be happy. And they were saying these things to be nice, to be supportive, but those sentences got stuck. And clogged you up, as you said, you were taught how to suppress those emotions and to be happy and to be strong. Were you taught how to cry or how to connect with grief?
No, and interestingly enough, you know, I come from a very loving family that's always been there, supportive, but we weren't emotional per se as a family, where we talked about it and cried. And I remember the last time I cried before losing Liam, and it was 10 years before that, when I thought I was going to lose my grandma. She lived for a couple of more years, but I thought she was on her last breath. And it wasn't that I thought it was wrong to cry. I just didn't. And, you know, from not crying for so long to crying several times a day and crying, I wrote about it in my book as well, you know, crying and not caring who saw, you know. And I don't care too much about other people's opinion when I do care about my friends and my family's opinion of me as a human being. If I'm not a nice person, if I do something that's unfair and someone tells me, hey, you shouldn't be like this, that I care about. And as you know, when it comes to social media and so on, there's a lot of people that have opinions,
yeah, for sure,
that you don't know, and quite frankly can't put themselves in your shoes. So that I didn't care about. I learned very quickly not to look too much at social media, because you get some you know, horrendous comments sometimes. And
those opinions, and they have always been there.
Yeah.
So social media just gets you connected to those opinions that were always there.
Yeah, no, it's true. And then the internet, you know, it brings out the best in the world, but also the worst in the world. And
you get everything, all inclusive.
Yeah, yeah. But I felt that I really had to focus on myself and my wife. And you know, when she got pregnant again with Nico, Liam's little brother, you know, at first I didn't think she was going to be able to get pregnant again, just because, you know, she was in such deep of a depression, and it's but she did, and then you've got to look at all the potential risks that come with the pregnancy. You know, having a miscarriage is fairly common, and once we're past that stage, dealing with the birth and having a child that looked very much like Liam and was born in the same room as Liam by the same doctor as Liam. And usually when you have a younger sibling, you know, you have the hand-me-downs and the clothes and the toys, and to make sure that Nico felt that he had his own personality, his own identity, and he wasn't a replacement child, and not ever feeling that he's living in his brother's shadow, and see, okay, you know, these toys were Liam, so those he cannot have, and certain clothes and certain toys he can play with. You know, the frog obviously is something that's not a toy that he will be playing with, but it's such a chaos, and it's something that's so difficult, because it's not a real true path. What's the right thing to do? What's the wrong thing to do? Well, it's dependent on who we are as people, what type of a child we want to raise. And it's like your whole life that you had has just been shattered. And then you got to pick up the pieces and try to glue them together and create a new life after that. And that's something that's very, very difficult to do, and at the same time, very, very important to do, because if you don't, like I said, you, instead of just losing our son, our lives would have been lost as well. And that fight to make sure that his passing wasn't in vain is one of my number one driving forces.
I think I saw a video of you talking into the camera. It might have been just like hours after Liam's death.
It was.
And you have this clear, very focused connection to the camera and to the viewer, and you were talking very purposeful about how to move on and how to make sure that Liam's death wasn't in you know wasn't forgotten. What happened afterwards? I mean, during the grieving process, you had the new pregnancy, your new son, but also this struggle of trying to make a change.
You know, it's funny that you said that that video for some reason came up not long ago. I saw it again, and I remember it was the night. So once we knew that Liam wasn't going to make it, we decided to donate his organs. And that's something that people need to do more as well, become organ donors. And when we did, that meant we stayed at the hospital for a few more days. And, you know, that became our reality for those few days. We were so secluded in the hospital, and, you know, this became world news. And it was literally across the world, from Japan to Russia to, you know, and we didn't really realize at the time, and I still don't really know why. Me and my wife have spoken about it. Children pass away every single day. Someone dies in this country because of drunk driving every 49th minute. Mm. So this wasn't something new. Maybe it was because of the martial art world. People, you know, because even though he was so young and we had traveled a lot, he had met a lot of people. So, and he was very social for being so young, because he grew up at the gym. So he was surrounded by people all day long. But when we left the hospital, and that is one of the most difficult moments ever, where what you had been programmed to protect, having to walk away from that, and having not to just walk away, but to force my wife with me to leave his side, and you know, ultimately having to wheel her out in a wheelchair because she couldn't walk. And you know, when even though he was brain dead, it looked like he was sleeping, because he had a few scratches, but that was it. You couldn't really see that he wasn't there anymore. So having to leave the hospital, and that was the first night that we left, and we stayed in a hotel. We didn't want to go back to where we were, and there was so much media around it, and we wanted to be just with my family. And so that was the night. And Michelle had gotten some medicine to calm her down, and she had finally fallen asleep. You know, we hadn't slept really in several days. and her sister was still at the hospital, and Michelle finally fell asleep, and I was just sitting there with my own thoughts. And, you know, anger is part of grief as well. But that initial animalistic, the first thing I said when I got into the hospital and I saw a police officer, I said, who do I have to kill? And that police officer explained to me that it was a woman who was 72 years old that was driving the car. Automatically, when I heard that it was a drunk driver, I thought it was a young guy. And it just baffled me that it was an elderly woman. So that anger, which, by the way, is especially for men, you know, there's 7 stages of grief, and anger is usually what men tend to get, because that's an emotion that we know, yeah, that we're familiar with.
Yeah.
So to be angry is very easy. But my anger was more controlled, and I wasn't necessarily angry with the woman. To be honest, I don't care about the woman. I care about the society that allows this to happen in the first place. And when over 10,000 lives are lost every single year because of drunk driving, that's the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every single week, and nothing is done about it, that was my anger. So I just felt the need to it was me and the camera, it was my phone that I filmed that with, sitting out in the corridor of the hotel in the middle of the night. And it was honest. It was the beginning stages of what was to become Liam's Life Foundation.
And as I understand it, the alcohol limit in the States is 0.8.
So in Sweden we count it per promilles,
yeah,
and in the US is blood alcohol content. So here's 0.08.
0.08.
Yeah,
right.
Which in Sweden is 0.02.
Yeah.
So we used to have 0.08 back in the 80s in Sweden as well. And most European countries used to have it. And then
that's a lot.
It is a lot. And that's what people don't realize. Even I train law enforcement a lot. And when I do, I always, with the sheriff's department, for example, after I've done training sessions with them, I sit down with them and I speak to them. And I go out and I speak to high school kids as well. I've spoken to over 7,000 high school students in 2019 alone. And my first question is always, what's the legal BAC? And there's always someone among the high school kids that know. Law enforcement officers, of course, know what 0.08 is. But my next question is, how many drinks is that? And most people don't realize that's 4 to 5 drinks for an average male of 170 pounds within an hour on an empty stomach. A 0.08, you're not slightly impaired. You're drunk at 0.08. And so,
again, and what does BAC stand for?
Blood alcohol content. So there, and I should know this. The blood alcohol content is amount of alcohol in your bloodstream at that time.
Yeah.
So the biggest problem, we had the bill introduced in 2019, known as Liam's Law, in California alone. And it's about to die on January 20th. That bill will die, and it will die because the chair of the Public Safety Committee in California is not allowing the bill to be even voted on. And that's exactly
why.
Why? Because, and this is where, so originally I said, I'm going to lower the BAC on a national level, on the federal level, all across the United States. And I realized very quickly that this isn't going to happen on the federal level because the opposition is too strong. They have too much money. So the chair of the Public Safety Committee, his name is Reggie Jones Sawyer. He said, well, there's not enough statistics to show that lowering it would make a difference. Well, more than 100 countries have done it, and every single country shows that lowering it makes a difference. In my opinion, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that lowering it will make a difference. So we provided him with the statistics, and then he said, well, we don't need more minorities in California going to jail. Well, if you commit a crime, you commit a crime. But if you're between 0.05 and 0.08, you don't go to jail if you're a first-time offender. But it's a wake-up call, or should be a wake-up call, like, hey, what you did, because the problem in the United States, different from Sweden, is that it's not, drunk driving isn't looked upon as a crime per se. It's done by lawyers, doctors, police officers, judges, and you see movies where people are driving drunk and it's funny.
Yeah.
But people don't know that, you know, and I didn't know before the 3rd of September either, that 66% of the US population will at some point be affected by drunk driving. In California alone, 3 people die every single day because of drunk driving. it's the number one cause of death, violent death among children 0 to 14, more so than guns. And again, going back to guns, you know, and being from Sweden, it's very different. But there's a counter argument, whether you agree with it or not. There's a counter argument. Second Amendment is part of the culture, is part of, you know, the founding fathers' ideas of how the country should be set up. I don't think assault rifles for 18-year-olds was part of the plan at the time, but it's still a counter argument. But when it comes to drunk driving, you don't have a counter argument. You don't have an excuse to why you should be allowed to get behind the wheel when you've been drinking. So to me, it would have been easy, but we realized that we're going to go the route, state by state by state, because it makes it harder for the opposition to fight us. We're almost like the guerrilla army fighting the big alcohol. And Reggie John Sawyer, and this is something that I haven't actually, I think this is going to be the first podcast I'm openly speaking about it. The true reason to why Reggie John Sawyer isn't allowing the bill to be heard, I believe, and I'll be very happy for him to give me another reason, but I think it might have something to do with the fact that Budweiser sponsored his campaign with at least $30,000.
Oh crap.
Yeah.
So that's obviously not totally objective.
No.
But I'm still curious about what happens with the bill, because you said the bill dies in January, right now?
In a couple of weeks,
In a couple of weeks. What happens with the bill when it dies, and how come it's not even presented to be voted upon?
That's something that when you look at coming from a democratic country, and the United States is or should be a democratic country as well, as far as decisions should be made on what's best for the population. But the United States, and I didn't know this either, but we've, you know, part of our documentary that's coming out, Letters to Liam, is following our, they've been embedded with us for over 2 years. They were there when we went through the court case, when we started working with the nonprofit, saying, okay, where do we start? How do you change the law in the United States? And I didn't know this either. I had to learn, okay, you get a bill introduced that gets sponsored by a politician, and then it goes through a committee. So in this case, when it comes to drunk driving, it goes to the Public Safety Committee. And this is where the problem lies, where one man, in this case, Reggie John Sawyer, who's the chair, decides what bills gets heard or what bills get hurt or don't get hurt. And in this case, one person makes a decision that we are not even going to hear this bill. So that it's not even going to get voted on. That is not democracy. That's the highest level of legalized corruption in any developed democratic country that's to be found.
So is the only way through him?
It's through, so it goes, you can go two routes. So you can either go via the House of Assembly. So for people that watch what's going on with the impeachment with Trump, the impeachment got voted through in the House of Assembly. And then it moves over to the Senate. And that's where you're most likely going to die, the impeachment, because the House is Republican. Mm. But this is a bipartisan issue. It doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, if you're black or white. This is something that affects everyone. So in our case, it was an Assemblywoman Burke, that introduced the bill. It was also co-sponsored by a senator who's a Democrat, but also by another assembly member who's a Republican. It goes to show that this is an issue that's not just a Democratic issue or a Republican issue.
Right.
It's for everyone. So it goes introduced to the assembly side, and then it goes through a committee. And once it gets voted through the committee, it goes to the House of Assembly. If and when it gets voted through there, it goes to the House of Senate. Once it gets voted through in there, it goes to the governor, and he signs off on it.
All right.
So that's how you change the law. So you need all these steps in order to get the law to become a reality.
So what are your guys' next step? I mean, it's election year. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for you?
It is a good thing. Good question. It's a good and a bad thing. It's a good thing because politicians care about the voters, right?
Yeah.
They want votes. But it also is a year where politicians are very scared to bring up new, what some would consider something that's a law or a potential law or a bill, or if they sponsor a bill that's a little bit... in many ways, it's changing the way the structure of the country is now. It shouldn't, right? All we're saying is lower the BAC level so that less people would die because of drunk driving. But if it's controversial, many politicians will stay away from it because they're scared, not knowing how that's going to affect right. the voters. And a true politician shouldn't do that, right? A true politician should fight for what's right.
Right.
But when, and that's a problem in the United States. I don't know how much of a problem is back in Sweden, for example. But when you have career politicians that don't necessarily, and don't get me wrong, there's some great politicians as well. But when they don't care about what's right, but only what will get them the most votes, then we have a problem.
Right, right. So we have those in Sweden as well. Some are more in it for the career. Some of them are more in it for the political vision, and some are both.
I
assume. But I'm thinking that this could be an issue that could divide the voters. I mean, not only divide them like Democrats, Republicans, but you could divide them in any other way as well. And what I'm thinking is, I really support you guys doing this really important work, but are there other ways as well to educate and to raise awareness around the issue?
Well, another way of doing it would be to go the opposite direction, to go the Senate side, to get a senator to introduce the bill. So it will be reintroduced at some point. You have to make some changes to it and so on, but you can reintroduce a bill again. And I agree with you. That's part of the issue with any potential law change, right? That you can divide the people. But again, this is something that there's very few bills or potential law changes that can be backed by so much science and so much statistics, because this is something that's been done. And I've even had this counter argument by someone pretty high up who said, well, you know, because I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to make a difference. And I'm not a career politician, so I don't care what, if I burn bridges or if I say something that I know is the truth, even if it will not go, it will go against what mainstream people think and feel. So this person said, well, there's not enough statistics. I can provide you with the statistics. And I did. And then they said, yeah, well, you know, we're looking at these European countries. They're different from the United States. But that's not true, because alcohol has the same effect. It doesn't matter what religion or race or, you know, what political party you belong
to. Different in what way?
That's what I asked as well. And there is no difference, right? But just like, well, you know, it's different. And this is the frustrating part at times. It's not my opinion. Science shows what each 0.01 of alcohol does to us as far as impairment. We know that. That's science, right? And two, we have these statistics from all these countries that have done it. So we can show, and by the way, more than 100 countries, not a single one of them is showing anything different than that if you lower it. You know, and I get the counter argument that, well, it doesn't stop anyone from driving drunk. Of course it doesn't. Just like any law doesn't stop anyone from breaking it.
Right.
But for the majority of the people, just like texting and driving. I remember the last time I texted and drove. It was the day I left the hospital with Liam. And before you know of anything, you know it's, oh, this probably isn't a good thing to text and drive. But then when it became a law over here and they did a big campaign on, here's the numbers, here's the statistics of when people drive and text. And you realize, whoa, this really isn't a good thing. And when I had Liam in the car and I said, oh, I shouldn't text when I have my son in my car. And I thought, what a selfish opinion. I don't do it when my son is in the car, but what if I risk someone else's life? And that's the thing. If you decide to drink yourself to death, that's a really sad thing to do, but that's a decision that you make that affects you. But when you decide to get behind the wheel when you've been drinking, it's no longer your decision to make, because now you're risking other people's lives. And so, you know, when I had this person say, well, you know, this is America, it's different. It's not different. And there is no difference. And again, we know, and actually now I can tell you that we know, because Utah was the first state to lower it in the United States from 0.08 to 0.05. January 1st of 2019. We were in Utah when this happened. And
was that thanks to you, to your struggle and to your...
No, we weren't involved, but we did model our introduction of the bill in California, and I was in New York to introduce the bill as well.
Who were behind the change in Utah?
I can't remember what group was behind it, but it was interestingly enough, there was a Democrat and a Republican working together to get this bill introduced, and it was turned down a couple of times, just like our bill was getting turned down now before it was introduced and passed. It's only been a year, but the last... Now, granted, we just had a couple of big holidays, right? But in the first preliminary report, drunk driving accidents were down over 50% in Utah in 2019, and fatal accidents, including drunk drive that involved a drunk driver, were down over 70%
in 1 year.
In 1 year, so to think that this wouldn't make a difference on a federal level, it's not just something that you it's more than stupid. Because stupid is when you don't know something or you refuse to face something. This is only to do with money. That the alcohol industry and the big alcohol are saying this is going to affect our profit. And you can never put human life secondary to profits, first and foremost. But what's really frustrating is there's studies to show that if people are not driving, they're willing to stay out longer and drink more. So if you look at European countries, including Sweden, Germany, Holland, with much stronger drinking cultures than America, where we drink more per capita, yet we have a lot less deaths, you know, this fight, it just shouldn't be needed, you know? And that's why I know we're going to win in the long run. First and foremost, because I will never give up. I won't stop. And you can only hide facts and statistics and science for so long. So I feel like this has been a win regardless. We were told that this bill was never going to get introduced in California. Forget about it. You're up against giants. It's not going to happen. Well, they've never been up against someone like me either. So just to have the bill introduced was a huge milestone for us, a big step. And even though it didn't, or most likely won't be heard or go through, we've done something very, very important. And that's, we started a debate. And when you start a debate, that's how you educate. Mm. And when you can educate, it's only a matter of time. When I'm out speaking to high school kids, for example, they are not difficult to convince that you shouldn't drink and drive. They're already used to using Uber and Lyft and so on. And they said, yeah, of course you shouldn't drink and drive. The hardest people to change are the older generation.
All right.
And I've even had people make dumb enough statements to say things such as, I actually drive better when I've been drinking. It's not your opinion. It's a fact. What alcohol does to you has been proven. And it's independent studies in many different countries. We need to get better and listen to what scientists say, not what politicians say, not what celebrities say, what scientists that have no potential gain in making a change. The only thing they provide is facts. And that's important.
Now I get what you meant with saving lives and making more money. That you need to tick both boxes to be able to make this happen. I mean, if you're not saying, you're not telling people to drink less, are you?
Not at all.
You're just telling them to stay home, drink more, and don't sit in your car.
Yeah, and the biggest opposition is a group called the American Beverage Institute, which is a non-profit, and that's one of the ways that they set it up, so that they come up with fancy names, so they can look like, oh, we're not here to do what's not best for the people. We are just, and they're not lying. They've gotten very good at skewing facts, and the man behind it, his name is Rick Berman, his own son. Has completely broken his relationship with his father, saying my dad is a demon. He was on 60 Minutes. They called him Dr. Evil there. He's also the man that says a secondhand smoke doesn't kill. Trans fats aren't bad for you. Refined sugar isn't bad for you. He's just a great human being overall. And what they do is they do this pseudoscience statistics saying, oh, drinking and driving isn't the problem, texting and driving is the problem. That's also a problem. It doesn't take even a third of the amount of lives as drunk driving does. But to point the finger at a separate problem doesn't solve the problem at hand. And they try to make us look like a neo-prohibition organization saying, oh, they're against alcohol. Like you said, we're not against alcohol. People can drink as much as they want. That's not what we're trying to do. All we're saying is don't get behind the wheel when you've been drinking.
I mean, I bet there must be a lot of numbers and statistics from European countries on the alcohol consumption after passing these laws. I mean, it shouldn't be that difficult to dig some numbers up and show him that the consumption doesn't decrease.
They're not looking for common sense. They're not looking for science. They're looking at pleasing their employer.
And I mean, that would please their employer. If the alcohol consumption doesn't decrease after passing a law, then it should.
That's a good point. We've obviously spent hours and hours on this, and one of the theories, I think, might be that it's the scare tactics,
right,
where this man is looking at the opportunities, saying to the big alcohol companies, "Hey, changing that law would hurt your profits, would hurt your bottom line. You need me. You need me to defend what's going to make sure that you're..." And that's what they did in Utah. So we were in very close contact with the politicians in Utah, asked them how they'd done it, what were the biggest issues, why did their bill get shut down the first couple of times?
Right.
And that's exactly what they were using. They were using... they would go to the restaurant associations and saying, "Hey, you guys need to support us. We're fighting for you. And if you don't, your revenues are gonna hurt. So you need us." So I don't even necessarily think that all the alcohol companies or the restaurant or nightclubs or bars, that the owners of those are evil human beings. I just think that they've been misinformed. And that's why we're here, to inform them.
Oh, so it narrows down to lobbyists getting things done, right? Like it narrows down to these lobbyists getting work.
Exactly. And they are obviously good at selling themselves, saying, "Hey, you need me to do this job for you." And the big alcohol companies, they're not stupid. They know every alcohol commercial ends with "drink responsibly."
Yeah.
And I even reached out to Budweiser. I told Budweiser, "Stand behind us. Stand behind what we do. Your advertisement says drink responsibly."
For sure.
Here's an opportunity for you to brand yourselves,
yeah,
to show that, hey, we do care. And Budweiser said, "Unfortunately, we can't support you. We can send you some swag if you want." And
swag?
Yeah, like a bag of like Budweiser towel or bottle opener. And, you know, when you fight for what we're fighting for, it's kind of a slap in the face.
It is.
Yeah. So it's that's why the opposition, Rick Berman and the American Beverage Institute, they set up nonprofits. Because at first, when I found American Beverage Institute, and I thought, why are they opposing what we're doing? And when we went to Washington to meet with watch groups out there, Rick Berman is a notorious figure in Washington. He's very well known over there. And I found out the reason why they open nonprofits is because you can donate to a nonprofit and stay anonymous. So clearly they know that this is a fight that is a dirty fight that they're for. And that's why I'm here. I'm here to expose that. And you know, I'm not a politician. I'm not doing this. There's no gains in this for me. Even though I've read all the theories, some people are, you know, someone thought that me and Michelle, my wife, that we are spokespeople for Uber and Lyft. So, and I wish, you know, Uber and Lyft, I would love to see some money go to the nonprofit, because it's expensive and it's very time consuming to do the work that we do.
I mean, those companies are doing well. Maybe they could afford a lobbyist for you guys.
You would have thought. And we've reached out to them.
Right.
And again, this is something that's controversial. And we found out that the reason Uber, especially here in California, and Lyft as well, you know, they are fighting being independent contractor versus being an employer.
Mm.
It's a big fight that Uber and Lyft have to fight across the world, but especially in the US and especially in California. So most likely...
They have their own fights.
Yes, and they don't want to stick out even more and say, "Hey, we support this too."
All right.
So
I love the fact that you're approaching this purpose or this mission so warrior-like.
I feel like one is the only way I know, really. But also because, and that's one of the reasons I know we're going to win. Because again, politicians do this either for money or for popularity. I'm doing this for my son. It's a fuel that will never end, you know. And I know I'm fighting for the right thing again because it's been done so many times and proven to work. You know, I'm not going to stop. And once we get to 0.05 nationwide, and someone asked me, by the way, why don't you want it to be 0.02 like in Sweden? Of course I do. But if I'm fighting this hard just to get it down to 0.05, yeah. But once we get it to 0.05, we can wait a couple of years and now we will have statistics. In fact, we already have statistics. The United States of America used to be a 1.0. And then during the Clinton administration, it was lowered. And that was arbitrary. That was just a number they thought was good. Let's lower it from 1.0 to 0.08. And the amount of deaths went down by about 15%. Again, it's not...
Who did that?
That was MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So Mothers Against Drunk Driving for a while didn't support our bill. And then they had a new CEO step in and... I called them out on social media. I use social media to call people out. And I wrote Mothers Against Drunk Driving, why don't you support our bill? And they had just changed. Her name is Helen. And she also lost her daughter to a drunk driver. And once they stepped in and supported our bill and helped introducing the bill in other states as well, including New York, Michigan, a couple of more states. And I said, you guys were the ones that introduced it.
Right.
And you saw the difference. Why would you not continue the fight? And since they stepped on board and support our fight, you know, MAD is a huge, both national and international nonprofit. And they got it lowered to 0.08. I don't know what their reason to fight it then was, but I love that they did. And again, it was arbitrary. We have a study put together by the National Academies of Science that is an 800-page report, including European countries, by the leading expert on drunk driving who's on our advisory board for the nonprofit. Again, these are scientists that don't have any second, you know, hidden agenda behind it. And they show, look, by lowering it from 0.08 to 0.05, I wanted to lower it to 0.04 originally, but the study that they had was to 0.05. Let's lower it to 0.05 first. Then when we have a couple of years of statistics of what that made, then let's bring it down to 0.02.
Right. And when you model these other countries, like the European countries who passed these bills, are there other... activities, other campaigning after passing the bill that helps the issue?
It's a good question. In Utah, when it was lowered, the American Beverage Institute didn't stop. And they continued with smear campaigns, putting up big billboards when you drove into Utah saying, go to Utah on vacation, leave on probation. And the one problem with Utah being the first state is that Utah is a Mormon state and Mormons don't tend to drink alcohol anyways.
All right.
So they're saying, oh, it's only lowered because it's a religious state. But I don't care what the reason was to why it was lowered. Now, the politicians that introduced it weren't necessarily, it wasn't because of a religious reason. They just, I love the politician who introduced it in New York. New York politicians are a little bit tougher. And when I stood next to me, she started his speech by saying, I support this bill because I have a brain. And that is about as far. And again, it's one thing not to know. It's one thing to be ignorant, not to be educated on a topic. But once you know, once you see the statistics, once you know how big of a problem it actually is, then you're either very selfish or you have tendencies of that of a sociopath because clearly you don't care. But it's a fight that we are going to win. But my problem is, what do I do then? Because I have now been exposed to the political system in the United States. And that's a problem.
I think there might be another dimension to it as well. While I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about, you know, the definition of freedom in this country, the sense that people have of the oppressor or the state, you know, telling you what to do or not to do. And I don't think, I mean, the issue of gun control driving while under the influence, I don't think it's actually always about the issue at hand. I think it's about the symbolic issue or the more of the philosophical issue is associated with what you're doing. It's like a 14-year-old angry boy, you know, don't tell me what to do.
Yes.
It's kind of legit, you know. According, I mean, if you look at the history of the country, and it's kind of legit when you think about the existential dimension of it as well. People don't want to feel trapped or being told what to do or not experiencing the freedom of having the power of your own life or controlling your own life, and when someone tells you not to drink and drive, it's not about the drinking or the driving. It's about that someone telling you what or not to do.
That's very true. And that is one of the major differences with America. And you know, I live it for a reason. I love America for many reasons. And that's being one of them, that, you know, people are accepted the way they are, and you can be who you want to be.
And Swedes are used to being told what to do by the state.
Yeah.
We have a huge state and this, you know, tradition of if anything's dangerous, the state will prohibit it.
Yeah.
And we're used to that. We are used to being that kind of species.
And we are. That's the thing. We are that species. We are a species that needs to belong, and we, you know, I there's a Swedish psychiatrist that I love, Anders Hansen, who I love listening to. His latest book on social media that he wrote, and you know how we hate not being part, not feeling like we're part of something, right? And that's because back in the days, that meant if you don't belong, you're going to die because we can't survive on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So the individualism that we have in America, I love that. And I can tell, I've lived here for long enough where when I go back home to Sweden, there's times where I remember someone saying, we don't do that here. And you know, there's pros and cons with everything. And the Swedish model of, you know, the socialistic model of we do these things together. There's some cons with that as well.
For sure.
Where you know, as an immigrant, you know, we are not used to that way of living, and we don't do that over here. Whereas in America, it's embraced. Oh, you do it that way? That's fine.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about America. But when it comes to what's better for people, and the population as a whole, that's where we gotta fix that we gotta bridge that in between, you know, the okay, you can do what you want and you can live and be who you want to be as long as it doesn't hurt someone else.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And I agree with that, American. I can tell my philosophy or my persona has probably been very influenced by America. When I go back home to Sweden, I see, you know, this is how we live, and I have a different opinion, and you shouldn't stick out too much. But that's a problem, because I love that you can be whoever you want to be, and that's groundbreaking in many ways, right? And accepted for who you are. But we do have to remember that we do have a responsibility towards society as well. Mm. And if you look at America, and I'm sure, you know, growing up, you know, you looked at to Americans as these tough and hardworking people. And when the lobbying system was introduced in America, if you look through the 80s, 90s, 2000, you know, education in this country, Americans at this point, you know, are ranked number 28th in the world when it comes to education. Obesity be the number one is now the number one killer in the country, and the mental health problem. When you talk about guns, usually the argument for pro guns. And again, I'm not against guns. I want to make that very clear. I'm somewhere in between on the two. But when you say guns don't kill people, people kill people. mental health is the issue, not guns. Well, how about we don't give assault rifles to people with mental health issues? But the mental health issue stems from this individualism. I'm going to make it on my own, right? And like you said, it comes from, you had pioneers come into this country,
right,
and they had to depend on themselves.
Yeah.
It was a lawless country in the beginning, especially here in the West, right? The Wild Wild West. But now, when society has moved on and we have come so far, America in certain areas is falling behind. And the tough, hardworking Americans, the baby boomers, the World War II heroes, you know, you look to America today, and unfortunately, and of course, when you have 300 million people, you've got some absolutely amazing people that come with that. But when the general population is suffering from both physical and mental health, then it's time to look at the political structure and go, this doesn't work. We have to make a change. It was working better before, and it's not working now. And that's where I'm a little concerned, because I can't stop. I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't stop this movement that we've started. And then the question is, am I going to be able to change the whole political structure in the country? Or, you know, what's option two? JFK?
Right. And I mean, it's not, I get what you mean by individualism being a core issue. I don't believe that individualism itself is the problem,
but I agree,
like the extreme version of it. And in the same manner, like the extreme version of socialism also creates a really disability, I mean, a limiting kind of idea.
Absolutely.
But if you have like the balanced version of it, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I think actually we need both. I think
we need both.
The collective thinking and the individual thinking as well. But what I'm pondering about is that sometimes when, especially in Sweden, when the state tells us what to do or not to do, when there's all these laws, people get stupid. They don't think for themselves.
Yeah.
And there's always a risk with just, you know, enforcing laws and not educating people and not telling them the depth of the issue and not helping them to develop psychologically to be able to make that sound judgment themselves.
Absolutely. And if you look at the United States, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, the fight today, the fight is in many ways against Islam, in many ways, right? If you look at the countries that they fight, and it shouldn't be, as you know. But there's, in many ways, a hidden agenda, right? It's down there. But when the fight was against communism, I understand that fight to a certain extent, right? Where, like you said, people just follow blindly and can't think for themselves and don't have the right. That's the most amazing thing with America, the freedom of speech, right? Yeah. That you have the right to stand up and say, fuck the president. And you're not going to get, you might have people who have an opinion on it, but you're not going to get killed for it or hurt for it or shunned by society necessarily. And that's what, that was what America was fighting at the time, was freedom. And I agree with that, right? I agree with the freedom of speech and the right to be able to stand up for whatever you want. And even if I don't agree with it, you have the right to say it, yeah, right? But when your actions can potentially hurt someone else, not just one time, but over and over and repeated in a repeated manner that we see with drunk driving, for example, or mass shootings, for example.
For sure.
Then there's an issue. There was a shooting not long ago, just a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, the counter argument was, look, here was all these other people that were carrying, that were able to kill the mass shooter. And again, of course, one is a retired police officer. If you have no history of mental health issues and you're not a criminal, then owning a gun won't be an issue to you, because you have proven that you can be trusted with a weapon. But if there's no proper background check, then that's when we have these issues, when high school kids can go in with an assault rifle and kill many, many people in a very short amount of time. That's the whole purpose of an assault rifle, is to take human lives, as many as possible, in a short amount of time as possible.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree with it's a surreal argument that you should allow you know, any sorts of guns. I mean, an assault rifle isn't, there's no argument for that. Right.
Right.
But I can also see the fear behind it. Like the whole slippery slope argument. First, they take our assault rifles and they take everything. And I think there's a way to it to be able to not only persuade people, but to be able to help people feel safe, like help people to get on your side. There's a place for the warrior and there's a place for the king.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm also brought up, you know, I feel very connected to my warrior because I needed him. I needed the warrior to be able to stay alive. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my warrior. But also as I grow older, I realize that there's a place for the king as well because then people listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's hard sometimes because I feel that warrior energy in me and I really want to tell people to shut the fuck up.
Yes.
But I realize that that's not a very constructive or productive way to go.
And that's the problem, because a door can only open inwards, right? So and I feel what you feel at times when I read these comments, when someone tell me, oh, you know, this isn't a problem, and I want to just grab them and shake them and go, it is a problem.
Yeah.
You don't have the right to say it's not a problem because you haven't done the research that I have done. You haven't educated yourself on the topic the way I have. And here's one of the biggest problems is that people read something that's been shared on Facebook and go, oh, well, now I'm an expert because I read this article. And then I want to urge people to go, this is what you have to do first. Once you read the article, you have to go and find out what source posted that article and who do they represent. And that's what's done over here. You hear fake news a lot. So a lot of these articles, for example, that on drunk driving with these skewed facts, one of them that was put on by the ABI, for example, saying 0.08 isn't a problem. Most fatal drunk driving accidents happen at 0.15 BAC or higher. Well, all that tells you is the more you drank, the more likely you are to be in a fatal crash of drunk driving. That doesn't prove anything. But the way it's been produced makes it look like, hey, here's some people, like same with the environment as well. Like, do I believe it's as big of a problem as some people make it out to seem? I don't know, because I haven't educated myself enough on the topic. But there's a lot of independent scientists from different countries that all say, hey, we have a problem with the environment. When you have people that have spent a lot of time researching, then you have to at least listen to what they have to say. And we as, you know, your average population, you know, the people of the population, we need to go, because what happened was before social media, people could do things and hide it. Big companies can do things and it wouldn't come out. They've realized that, hey, we can't hide the truth from coming out, but what we can do is we can skew it.
Yeah.
We can provide counter articles saying, no, that's not, and it's pseudoscience, right? And so as people, we don't have the right anymore to be ignorant. We don't have the right to stay uneducated on topics. We need to look at the article that was written and then find out who wrote that article. What's their stance on the whole thing? And, you know, like with guns, like I have a gun license. I'm licensed to own a weapon. And again, I understand the need for people to have weapons. And I don't think if you're a good law-abiding citizen that you should be banned necessarily from owning a gun. But we live in California, which is considered one of the strictest states when it comes to guns. For me to get a gun license took 3 days. It would take me longer to get a library card than to get a gun license. And the questions that are on the questionnaire to get the gun is or the license is ridiculous. Do you have any history of mental health? Me being able to cross no on there, in my opinion, isn't a professional way of finding out if I should have the right to own a weapon. So
maybe someone else should do that evaluation, not yourself.
And that's where the problem lies in this country, unfortunately, is that, and you know, the purpose behind social media and the internet should be to be able to find facts and education and so on. But with these very powerful groups of very intelligent men and women have realized that, you know, we can get people to believe this or believe that. So what we're finding now is, even within the country, right? Mm. Democrats versus Republicans, Christians versus Muslims, white versus blacks, that is, I think we're becoming more and more segregated because everyone wants to belong, right? There's a great documentary on Netflix called, I can't remember the name of it, but Flat Earth. And to believe that the earth is flat in today's society is not very bright, right? But then you look at some of the people that stand behind it and you realize they're not stupid, but they want to belong.
Yeah, and I don't actually think that they believe in the flatness of the earth.
Exactly.
I think there's a couple of layers to that. I think, first of all, as you say, it's belonging. It's belonging to a narrative, and it's also being listened to, because when they do those kind of... They have like conferences and they have these meetups and they create a lot of attention and people listen to them. I mean, not listen to them as in listening deeply, but they get the attention.
Almost for entertainment value, yeah.
Of course. And I think it started actually as a way to troll people. I think it started as a collective of Reddit people on Reddit trying to get some attention, and they started to troll their opponents. And then it just kept spinning. I actually don't believe that the majority of the flat earthers actually believe that the earth is flat, but they love the reactions. They love the attention, and it's no way they can back out of it now.
Exactly. And then you get, you know, these people that now have status within a group, and that's very important as well as humans, right? One, we want to belong.
Yes.
Once we belong, we want to have status within that group. And so now you and what's good about that documentary, it's not just the fact that you have people that believe the earth is flat, it's the psychology behind it, and that you belong to something, right? And anytime you belong to something, as a human, as we function as humans, it's got to be us and it's got to be them.
Mm.
And it's now us versus them. And that's what's happening, especially because I live in the United States, is where I see it the most, where now it's us, whether you're Republican or Democrat, versus them. And you have to remember, even Donald Trump, who, in my opinion, isn't a great president. And I'm not even... You know, someone said, well, you know, I was in a discussion where there was a couple of pro-Trump fans and some that were against. And I said, we don't have the right to say if he's doing a good job necessarily, because we are not with him on a day-to-day basis. I don't know what Donald Trump does on a day-to-day. I don't know what decisions he makes. I don't know how many of the decisions he made himself or how many were done by the people that work around him, right? So, but I can say the public figure that he is, in my opinion, I don't like who he is as a person because he's a bully, and I don't like bullies. But I agree with a lot of the Republican views. And you have to remember, even whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, the other side is not trying to hurt the country. Even Donald Trump, I don't believe, is trying to hurt the United States. He's doing what he thinks is best for the country. And that's really important, that when you go into a discussion or a debate or an argument, to remember that I need to hear what that person's opinion is. Now, ultimately, it will come down to certain differences in values, right? If you're pro-abortion or if you're against abortion, it can come from religious or culture or social values that you have from when you grow up, right? But to understand and respect the other opinion. Now, I'm not talking about your most extreme, right, of anything, whether it's a religious group or if it's just a hate group, right? That's different. But when you talk about regular people, we have to go, okay, I don't agree with this. Why do you believe this is the right thing to do? And then you can start a debate. And that's when a door can potentially open inwards.
That's what I mean. When you talk about drinking and driving, people don't hear that.
No.
They hear that you're messing with their belief system.
Yeah.
Like subconsciously, that's what they not hear, but that's what they experience.
Yeah.
And they see you as the other, as the opponent. So that's why I'm thinking sometimes like the pushing, the warrior like energy might be counterproductive. And in some parts of this struggle, it's necessary.
Yeah.
Like you standing up to the alcohol companies, it's like this David versus Goliath kind of play. It's this drama, and you need to be persistent, and you need to build up that warrior fire within you. Then sometimes when you meet people like regular Americans who find your campaign as a almost like a critique of their way of living,
yeah,
then maybe switching into another mode, something softer, because those people don't hear your, I mean, they don't, even if you tell them about the story of your son, they're hearing something else.
And that's exactly what it is, because I've learned from doing, from trial and error, right? And especially, you know, when it comes to the debate on social media where people can stay anonymous.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had people, you know, it's very, when someone tells you that, you know, the passing of my son was God's will, you know, it's very hard to take a deep breath and go, okay, I can respond with fuck you. Or if I want to change that person's opinion, I have to ask them, why do you think it should be a 0.08? Because a lot of times, because people don't know what it actually means,
yeah,
someone goes, oh, no, I can't even have a beer and get behind the wheel. What kind of shit is that? And then you go, no, actually, a 0.05 for an average male, you could probably have two beers.
Yeah.
And if you're out for dinner, for example, and then be able to drive home. In my opinion, you shouldn't. If you've had one or two beers, just get an Uber. Or yeah, if you can afford a drink at a bar, you can afford a $15 Uber ride.
Right. Sure.
And then you don't have to worry about parking and so on, which is hard in Los Angeles. But I've had to learn to go, okay, I won't be able to change everyone's opinion. But if I respond with, fuck you, all I'm doing is fueling his belief system of, well, clearly this isn't a good person.
Yeah.
Because I've done this as well. We're like, oh, this is your opinion? Let me provide you with facts. Here's some science. Here's some facts for you. And like you said, they don't hear or see that. So what I have to do instead is to calmly sit down and say, okay, why do you think it should stay at 0.08? And usually the arguments are not very strong. But that's the only way that you can change that opinion. And to my disadvantage, in many people's opinion, is, are you from another country? Are you come from a socialistic country? You're just trying to control us, yeah, like you said.
Yeah.
And that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that we're trying to do anything. Again, drink as much as you want. But we have proven, when over 10,000 lives are taken every single year in this country because of drunk driving, isn't it time that we did something about it? And that's the problem. And that's human's problem in general, right? Where we, doesn't matter if it's the United States or Sweden or Italy or any other democratic country, you will have different opinions. But what's really important in whatever the topic of discussion is, to go in with the mindset that here's another person that's trying to do, because it happens every single day within your family, with your partner, within my business, mm-hmm, right? We have different opinions. We all want to go in the same direction. We want to be successful, but we have different opinions.
So in my experience, people don't want you to change their minds.
Yes.
And if I feel like someone is in a conversation with me with a purpose, single purpose of telling me I'm wrong, yeah, I'm not prone to listen to that person. So when I feel that someone is interested and curious about me and they listen to me, I feel more dedicated to the conversation. I feel like I wanted to listen to that person because he is listening to me. So I would say the best hack, like the best conversational hack or trick, not even trick, it's like it's being human, is even if you don't agree with someone, start out by listening to them, like being truly curious about their life, and that helps them to be curious about you.
Yeah. No, it's 100% true, and I do this with training as well. You know, yeah, I have some really talented fighters that are in the UFC and so on, and they, you know, it comes with a certain entitlement, and rightfully so. They worked very hard to get where they're at, but then when it comes to coaching, and they say, "Well, I'm this person. I've done this. I got this anecdote. I got this accomplishment in, to my name," but people don't care. And this is not my saying. This is a famous coach who said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's very, very true, because, and that's can be very common in America, I've realized, when people feel the need to tell you their opinion. And you're right. What you can do is speak a little bit louder and cut them off and tell them your opinion. And that's a great recipe for an argument.
Mm.
Or you can hear them out and then say, but what about if we did it this way? Would it hurt your values? Would it hurt your ego? Because that's truly what it comes down to a lot of times, right? Ego. Ego, it's one of the worst things where we get proven wrong. But as a human, if you want to grow as a human, you have to be able to take constructive criticism.
Mm.
And I say this all the time. Even if you're the best fighter in the world, that doesn't mean that you don't have areas that you need to work upon, that you can improve upon, right?
Right.
And it's the same thing as United States of America. It's the greatest country in the world in so many ways. It's the reason why I live here. It's the reason why I have an American citizenship. I like living. I'm proud of living in America. But that doesn't mean that there's not certain areas that need to improve.
For sure.
And that's where I think Americans can improve overall as well and go, there's other countries that do things really well as well. And especially when you're in a country like America, where you can go, okay, they do that really well. Why don't we try to adapt it here and then make America even greater than it is?
So how's the documentary going? Letter to Liam, I saw the trailer, it was really moving, really touching.
Yeah, it's, and again, this is another area that I wasn't, you know, I've been in some shows, but being part of, you know, they've been embedded with us for over 2 years. And at times it's very difficult to have cameras in your face when all you want to do is be alone. And especially when it comes to grief. But we also, me and Michelle, realized that if we truly, truly want to make a difference, we have to allow the cameras to be there, even in the most difficult of moments. And, you know, we chose to be public with what happened, right? Part of it, we didn't choose because it was media, but we could have let that die out, right? And then we chose, so when we made that decision that we are going to fight this, we had to be okay with there's going to be opinions on the other side as well.
Yes.
So.
But is it out?
It's not out. It's in post-production.
Right.
But the problem with a documentary like this, you know, they had originally created a docu-series.
Right.
It's 4 series because there's so much to it. And then Showtime had asked for just a documentary. They don't want it as a series. So they have to take 4 episodes and compose it into 1. So it's in post-production, and the problem with a documentary like this, there's no like a regular movie, there's an end, right? We don't have an end. Right now we have an end to a bill dying on the 20th of January, but this fight is going to continue. So this constant, like, okay, we're done, and then something else happens. Oh, we got to just add that, let's film that and add that in. So sometime during 2020 it's going to come out, and I'm excited about it because nothing, in my opinion, will tell the story better than the documentary as far as educating the people on the problem with drunk driving and grief and, you know, losing a child. It has so much to it. And I do believe that it will be the catapult truly to lower the BAC in the US.
So the bill expires on January 20th. 20th,
yeah.
And the documentary will be out sometimes during this year.
Unfortunately, it won't come out before the bill. We were hoping that it would, but it won't. And I think in the second, third quarter of 2020, it should be out.
So are there any other next steps for you guys?
Yes. So if you look at the United States as a whole, the reason why we want to have this bill introduced in California and fighting so hard to do so. One, we live here, so it's obviously a lot easier. But California is also the world's 4th biggest economy. You know, historically, if California, New York, and a couple of more states decide to do something, the rest of the U.S. tend to follow suit.
Right.
So we are going to continue with this guerrilla warfare because, again, if I want to change the BAC on a federal level, the opposition can just focus on that one area, whereas more of a guerrilla warfare where we light fires in different areas, that's what we're going to continue doing and just continue educating the population. The more we continue, and unfortunately someone joins our team every 49th minute. Now most people, you know, whether they're consumed with grief and they can't take on the fight, but we have people that join us and say, I'm not going to let this happen to someone else. I will do this in my brother's, son's, sister's, daughter's, wife, husband's name and continue the fight. So through education and through, you know, the high school kids I'm out speaking to, it's only another 3-4 years until they can vote. So I know I'm in it for the long haul, you know. I can be very impatient at times and I want it to change tomorrow. But I've come to accept that this is going to be a very long fight, but it's also a fight that I'll continue to the day I die. One thing I did this year was I ran the Grand Canyon. And it was to raise awareness, right? It was something that stood out. But part of it was for myself as well, of the symbolism of if I can conquer one of the seven wonders of the world, that big mountain that was ahead of me, then no politician is going to be able to stop me either.
I mean, you must have days where you don't have like the grit or the energy to go into that warrior mode. What happens then? I mean, I bet you have those rainy days as well.
Of course, absolutely. Today was a hard day when I woke up and there was something about Liam, you know. Sometimes you can feel it coming on. Mm. Some days you wake up and it hits you like a truck. Those days and moments are a lot of times harder because you can't prepare for it. Yeah. As an example, we were just in Florida with my family and we went to this bounce place, yeah, which is for little kids. And Nico was there to jump. And they said, oh, yeah, you guys already signed a waiver. This is Liam. And I completely forgot that we were there with him a couple of years ago, you know, 3 years ago now. And, you know, you didn't expect it. You know, his birthday, the day he passed, those are days that you can prepare for. Yeah. And it's really, really important. And I was really bad at it. I've gotten a lot better at it. To be okay with not being okay. To accept that today is not going to be the most productive of days. Today I have to focus on myself. And it's hard. It's hard in my case because I'm a leader in the gyms. And to tell the truth, you know, it was to be a business owner and a small business owner at that in an early stage, you know, for almost 2 years, me and my wife, we were physically present, but we weren't mentally there, you know, because we had to focus on ourselves. So that's suicide for a business, right? So for a long time, you know, our business was hurting because of it. And then that passion came back with time. It didn't happen overnight. But till today, you know, and it's very common, especially for men, usually, when you look at grief, and there's always exceptions to the rule, but men tend to be doers. That's how we deal with grief. Yeah. I want to do. I want to change. I want to solve the problem. I want to fight. Yeah. And I did that. And I actually mentioned in the book that I kept going. And then one day I woke up and I couldn't get out of bed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't nothing physically wrong with me. And every day was difficult to get out of bed. And it's still days that are difficult to get out of bed. But you have to learn to accept, and it's hard. It's actually one of my weaknesses where I get upset with myself. Why am I being lazy? And it's not lazy. But one thing that I've learned to accept is I can't give 100% if I'm not 100%. And that's important to allow for those days. And you know, now 3 years down the road, it's not a day goes by without me thinking of Liam every single day. If not for seeing my bracelets or my own tattoo, there's always something that reminds me of Liam, whether it's Nico doing something who looks, and now, you know, Luna, Liam's little sister, she looks even more like Liam than Nico did when he was small. To seeing, you know, someone who's 4 years old and looking at him and thinking that, what would Liam be at 4 years of age? You know, that could be him now. But to be in touch with emotions and not to be afraid of your emotions, but to accept them and to remember we are not robots, and it can be hard, especially like you said, that warrior. But we have to remember that emotions isn't a sign of weakness. Tears isn't a sign of weakness. In fact, I believe you're stronger if you can be in touch with those, because then there's no hidden, you know, pockets of darkness, because you shine light on it yourself.
Yeah.
So.
And it's that dance, you know, between fighting and accepting. That's the hard path to to walk, because it's one thing to accept everything and not fight, and then there's another path where you fight everything and you don't accept anything. But the hard thing is to almost do both.
Yeah. Finding that balance is very, very difficult. And, you know, especially early, you know, I wanted to fight everyone. You know, if I saw someone, and until today, you know, if I would see someone that's been drinking and about to get into the car, I won't let them, you know. And friends and family, you know, family don't drink and drive because they're from Sweden, so most of them would never do it. And it's not because Sweden is better as a country, it's just that it's something that's socially not acceptable. And that's what we're trying to get to, because we have to burn the candles from both ends. You can change people, like you said, in Sweden, right, by changing the law. But you also need laws to be changed, because the people are saying, enough, we don't want this anymore, we want this to be different. And when you balance that fight and you realize that, like you said before, that you can't fight people on any topic, really, if it's just for the sake of fighting. But when it's for the sake of educating, and when it's for the sake of the better good, the big picture, then that's the way to do it. And that's what I know it's going to take time, because it's only two of us. Now, granted, we have an amazing team that works with Liam's Life Foundation, and, you know, they are people that care as well. But unfortunately, I believe to a certain extent that people have almost given up, because it's like, well, how can we change things? It's not in our hands. But we have to remember, we have to take that power back. It is in our hands.
Well, thank you for not giving up, and thank you for fighting, not only for Liam and yourselves, but for all of us. Thanks. And thank you for sharing your story. I was touched before I met you. I'm even more touched right now, and also reminded of the importance of, you know, sometimes creating these pockets of acceptance in the fight, because I'm struggling with that as well. And if any of our listeners would like to know more about you, they would like to support the foundation, how do they find you?
On Instagram is MacKowal. Liam's Life is Remember Liam's Life on Instagram, or liamslife.org is the website. From that website, on my own, MarcusKowal.com, people can find ways of being part of it. I wrote a book in English, is Letters to Liam. That's a documentary. So Life is a Moment is the name of the book that became an Amazon bestseller. And if you have a friend, family member that has ever experienced grief, I think it could be a good book that can help them in their process, in their work to find happiness again. And 20% of all books sold goes to the nonprofit as well. So,
and there's a Swedish translation as well, right?
Yeah, the Swedish translation it just came out as a audiobook, a lot more people today tend to listen to books. So the Swedish version is Liam en stund på jorden. It was a book difficult to write, but it was part of my outlet. It was my way of dealing with the grief. And I'm hoping, again, I know it already has impacted lives and it will continue to do so, but the most important thing for me with the fight for Liam is to make sure that other parents don't have to go through what we've gone through, and that Liam's passing made a difference on this planet.
Thank you. And in the end of every episode, we ask our guests to recommend someone that we can invite for a conversation. Who would you like to hear on the How Can We podcast?
There's so many people, because I think what you do is so important. It's such an important podcast. You know, there's I was really impressed when I saw when you sat down with Jimmy Åkesson, because you know, it's very easy to shun them, the opposition, right? Someone that, as an immigrant, you know, when you sit down and say, here's a man, from what I seem, from the perspective I have, it sounds like you don't want me to be here. And to be able to say, no, but let me hear your opinion. There's so many people like that, that you need to sit down with. And in America, I would say there's a lot of people. So I would love for you to get Joe Rogan on here because he has, you know, I think anyone listens to podcasts has at some point listened to Joe Rogan, and he has such great insight from a lot of the guests that he's had. I would love for you to sit down with Reggie John Sawyer and see his opinion on drunk driving. But I'd say politicians, any politician in the United States, and a person that I think is very honest and very open about being the best version of yourself is David Goggins.
Yeah, love Goggins.
Yeah. And a big inspiration for me when it came to running the Grand Canyon and doing an ultra marathon. I think, you know, and that's really what we do with my gyms here as well. You asked me earlier, you know, what's the goal? And my goal, martial arts has given me so much that I want to give back. And I think that's the best way of bridging those oppositions, right? When we realize that, hey, even if someone is Jewish or Muslim or Republican or Democrat, you know, on the mats, all of that disappears and we're just humans. So a martial artist would be great. And there's some martial artists that are very interesting to listen to.
For sure.
Shane Fazan would be good, who I have a podcast with as well, called Human, who has fight tips on YouTube. I think someone who's very interesting to listen to is Uriah Faber, and Chris Lieben is interesting as well, just because of his own struggles with drugs and alcohol and so on, and realize that even the toughest people on the planet, we all have issues and we all have problems. So in Sweden, I would love to hear one of the if you can sit down with the king, that would be amazing. But the royal family, because it's interesting to hear people who gets to see the world,
yeah,
but then representing Sweden, and they're on the outside of politics. Clearly they're involved as well, but to be able to sit down with someone and see their opinion, to hear who they are as humans, I think that would be interesting as well.
That would be amazing to podcast with the Swedish king. I bet he has a lot of stories.
Has he ever been on a podcast?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure he knows what a podcast is. All right, it's out there. So Marcus, thank you so much for being on the How Can We podcast. I'm really looking forward to see what you guys are accomplishing here in the States.
Thank you.
Perhaps inspiring people, but also creating more awareness around the issue.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being on the podcast. I hope you guys do well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Tack så mycket.
Tack.